Good morning. May it please the court. Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Rouse. The briefs are pretty complex, so I'd like to narrow my oral argument to just three narrower issues. The first one being the discovery violation of fire investigator Schneeberger. The second one being one part of the voluntariness argument, which is the lack of videotape. And the third argument I'd like to discuss is the Melendez-Diaz-Crawford confrontation issue. As to the discovery violation, in opening statement, defense trial counsel told the jury that there was no evidence of arson for fire number one, that nobody would say it was arson. But on day number two, when Mr. Schneeberger testified, he testified he changed his mind. Now, that's clearly a discovery violation. I know the prosecutor at trial and in the answer brief have argued that it wasn't exculpatory, so it wasn't discoverable under the rules, but that's not how Brady against Maryland and all the thousands of cases that have interpreted it since 1963. Materiality is the issue. That's what you have to disclose. And this was very material because it goes to the heart of the charges, arson. And that was a discovery violation of the largest proportion, and the judge should have granted the motion for mistrial because at that point, the defense counsel looked incompetent.
I'm sorry, can I finish your sentence, Mr. Carberry? I was going to ask, and I'll just say directly, and I would say this to your colleague across the aisle, I'm very sympathetic to this, the argument here that there's a discovery violation. I'm more concerned about why it's prejudicial. And I understand you say that the defense lawyer looked like an idiot, you know, but I guess I'd like you to tell me why is that necessarily so? Because the defense lawyer gets to make the expert look like an idiot. And the jury, I think, fully gets. You know, this lady stood up and said, hey, I relied on this, and now you've changed your mind. And so in terms of, I guess I'd ask you to address the prejudice issue.
Well, I think that really you can't say that the jury fully got that because the jury found him guilty. What happens here is this man is an officer of the court. He's a state employee. He carries this authority of the state. And he comes in and he says, you know, I investigated this the first time, but now I've talked to this other investigator, Mr. Dietus, about fire number three, and now I'm changing my mind and I think it's arson. I mean, that's the type of thing that it's not just, if defense counsel had known this long before trial, she could have negotiated a plea bargain. She could have had Mr. Rouse plead guilty. Or she could have tried to deal with that in a different way. It's difficult to say at this point, but she's stuck at that point when the trial is already commenced, the jury is sworn, evidence is presented, jeopardy is attached, and all of a sudden you have a totally new issue. It's difficult to actually show what was in the minds of the juries, but clearly they believed Mr. Schneeberger.
Is there any way for us to determine from the record when the prosecutor knew that Schneeberger was going to offer an opinion different from his written report that was disclosed?
Judge, that I could not find in the record, Judge Webb. I could not find that. But as the defense counsel said, the prosecutor had to have known this before this happened. And we don't have a way of establishing that, but we do know that it happened, and that's a difficult problem, and it's a difficult burden of proof for the defense at this point because we just don't know what the prosecutor knew. But we do know what the rule says: 30 days before trial, you have to disclose these statements. And if the prosecution learned this that day, then clearly we needed a mistrial. And as the
counsel, before we leave point. I don't recall seeing in your brief a citation that clarifies that if there's a discovery violation that's relied on an opening statement, that reliance in opening statement constitutes error.
Well, you
have some law that expounds on that prejudice that occurred. It's clear there's some prejudice if a defense attorney is led to make a statement that's not accurate or turns out not to be accurate. But you have some authority that deals with that particular kind of prejudice.
I don't have a precise cite for that, no, in my briefs, Judge. I could look for one, but no, I do not have that. And I will look for one and supply it to the court if you would like, Judge Nieto.
No, I'm not asking for more research. Do you know of any treatise that deals with that issue?
No, the closest thing that I can think of is my 20-year-old outline I made for the public defenders on prosecutorial misconduct. and I don't think that's really authoritative, or, you know, authoritative for the court. As to the voluntariness issue, you know, I know that there is no law in Colorado, and in fact, the Raybon case, I'm not sure if that's the correct way to pronounce it, says that the police don't have to interrogate, but that was a very old case. And as I stated in my briefs, even a child could have videotaped this alleged confession. And in this case, it's clear that the police deliberately did not videotape the confession. They could have gone to their sheriff's department, which is just around the Broncos field on there on Broncos Parkway, 2 minutes away from the jail, and videotaped the entire six-hour interrogation. And, you know, they admitted that they threatened him with murder charges, and it was after that that he confessed. But we only know about the demeanor and what happened in that room by the word of these police officers, nothing more. And that's wrong. And the courts, you know, I know that it's a slow process, but courts around the country are starting to require the police to videotape confessions. And that's a good rule because it lends transparency. And most prosecutors agree with that. In Denver, I've never seen a case for 20 years where the prosecution did not have the police videotape any statements. I mean, they always videotape them. In Jefferson County, Judge Nero, you know that they always videotape the statements. It was just, this is a unique case. And then finally,
Mr. Carver, before you move on, could I just a clarification on this whole confession point and the Fifth Amendment argument? I think you're only relying on the Fifth Amendment and Edwards line of cases. I was interested that the people started talking about the Sixth Amendment in their brief. Have you raised the Sixth Amendment violation argument?
I did not think I did either.
Okay.
I argued Edwards and that was, you know, Edwards and his progeny. And because, you know, he wasn't charged at that point. You know, they didn't charge him until after the confession.
Right. I didn't think I missed it, but I was a little confused. I wanted to make sure.
Thank you, Judge Gable. And then as to the Melendez-Diaz-Crawford confrontation issue, I know this is an issue of first impression, but fingerprint cards are always testified to by an expert. And you have to remember, there's two different sets of fingerprints cards here. There's the fingerprint card taken by the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office for the trial, and then there's the fingerprint cards taken by the Department of Corrections or by the other police agencies earlier. And those people need to come in and testify about those cards too, because that's what Melendez-Diaz talks about. It talks about the requirement of confrontation testimony. And that is what we ask for here. I know that over the years, the courts have lowered the burden of proof on habitual offenders. And, you know, years ago in DiGiosualdo against People, the Colorado Supreme Court specifically held that the habitual offender law is in derogation of the common law, and therefore it must be strictly construed. But over the years, the courts have lessened the strictness of the construction and have made it incredibly easy to be found guilty of habitual offender counts. But this is something that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken up recently, and I believe that in these cases, the confrontation right applies. I also believe, you know, I know that the Court of Appeals has held against me that you should have a right to a jury trial in these cases, too. I put it in my brief because I want to preserve it. I know that, you know, the courts have already ruled against me, but I'm asking the court to apply Melendez-Diaz to the fingerprint cards and to the pen packs because, you know, all these cases occurred in the metro area. It wouldn't have been incredibly difficult for the prosecution to bring in physical witnesses to testify about this.
Let me be, you're primarily saying that the technician who took the fingerprints that are in the pen pack has to be called to testify?
That, and also the person, the people who convicted him the first time need to be called in because the paperwork of this conviction was prepared specifically for this trial. That's Melendez-Diaz. If you prepare something specifically for a trial, you have a right to confront the preparers. And that's what I'm asking the court to find.
Doesn't that ignore the distinction that some paperwork is purely ministerial while others
you know, like a drug, weighing a drug specimen, for example, involves a measure of judgment in which, you know, mistakes could be made and cross-examination would be potentially useful?
That's exactly correct, Judge. You're right.
Well,
there is that distinction.
All right. Well, what purpose would be served by cross-examining the technician who took allegedly your client's fingerprints and put them in the pen?
Well, because fingerprints are often wrong. For instance, just a couple of years ago, the FBI was sure that a lawyer in Washington State was a participant in the Madrid train bombings. They had his fingerprints. They arrested him. They deported him to Spain, only to find out later that the fingerprints were wrong.
Well, what do you mean by wrong? You mean there was a deficiency in how the technician took them, or he just, you know, mixed up the names, or what?
There was a deficiency in the way the person examined the fingerprints to determine that he was the suspect.
Okay, but that's opinion testimony as to Mr. Gabriel's fingerprints are different than mine. I thought what you're saying is there has to be, they have to get the technician in there that took the prints.
I think so, because the taking fingerprints is not something done by anybody. You have to have training, and you have to do it right. And when you don't do it right, then you're subject to cross-examination. That's the issue, that we should be allowed to cross-examine these people, because experts fall apart under cross-examination often. We don't know if that would have happened in this case, Judge Webb, but it could have.
I understand you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Majid Yazdi, registration number 360-43, representing the people in this case. I will address the same issues that Mr. Carberry raised before this court on the discovery issue. As the court noted, there is no evidence in the record when the prosecution found out about the revised opinion of investigator Schneeberger.
Whose fault is it? I mean, the defense attorney can't cross-examine the prosecutor. I mean, it would seem to me that if the prosecutor says, I only found out about this an hour ago when I bought the guy coffee for breakfast, it was incumbent on the prosecutor to inject that into the record, not the defense.
Your Honor, there was a discussion on the issue before the court granted the request for recess to allow the defense additional time to prepare for cross-examination of Mr. Schneeberger. There's nothing during that discussion that addresses when the prosecution found out, and the court...
But I think you're not answering my question, which is, I agree with your reading of the record, but to the extent that we draw a negative inference from that, do we draw the negative inference against the prosecutor because he could have said, I only found out about this 10 minutes ago?
I can't think of any reason to suggest that the prosecution would not have indicated that if that was the case, that there was if the court had inquired about this or the defense had objected to this based on the fact that it was known before, then obviously this would have been revealed and we would have a record of that. But it seemed that the understanding of the parties was that, and the court was that, this was a recent revision based on other reports that Mr. Schneeberger had seen. And the court's position, which I believe is supported, I haven't found any authority, but to challenge that is that the fact that the statement was made in the opening statement, the comment was made that this is that no evidence will be shown that this particular fire was arson, is not evidence, and there is possibility that the expert may change his opinion, and the court considered that to be a normal procedure. And
How can that be normal, Mr. Yossi? Excuse me for interrupting you. How could that be normal procedure? I mean, I'm very concerned about what the rule is you're advocating. You say there's no discovery violation. I mean, the rule you would ask us to advocate or adopt would be that an expert could supply an opinion, and after that, as long as they don't put anything in writing, they can say whatever they want on the stand. How could that be the rule?
Especially in this case, Your Honor, that is not what has happened. Mr. Schneeberger's original opinion was that the fire could be arson, but it is not definite. So it was an undetermined, the conclusion was that it was undetermined, which means it could be natural, accidental, or incendiary. What happened, he narrowed down his opinion in the final stage of the investigation that he did to one of those and specifically identified it as an arson. So it is not a complete 180 degree change of opinion. It is further narrowing that decision or that opinion to one of those three possibilities. The defense already knew that he had not ruled out arson as a cause of fire. So just being more specific is more like clarifying the position that had been taken before, yes.
Whenever he learned of it, didn't he have a duty, the prosecutor that is, didn't he have a duty to bring that to the court's attention and defense counsel's attention before he produced it as evidence? I mean, the evidence or the report that the defense attorney has is that's an undetermined fire. The corpus delicti is not established at that point because you don't have an arson. Doesn't he have a duty to bring that to the attention of the court and his colleague before he has the witness testify to this before the jury? Whenever he learned of it.
It is true, Your Honor. Again, it is not a violation of Rule 16 because it is not exculpatory, but it is part of the ongoing duty of the prosecution to inform.
Are you suggesting that he's not testifying as an expert? I mean, there's a report written. Wasn't that discoverable as an expert report?
The report had not changed. It was his, Mr. Schneeberger did not have a duty to produce an amended report. He had already produced two reports, and based on that, that was the conclusion. But the final conclusion was not reflected in the report because he was not investigating that fire anymore.
Did they have a duty to disclose those two reports that they did in fact disclose?
Yes.
Then why didn't they have a duty to report and disclose a change in those reports?
Under which rule?
Rule 16.
Rule 16 requires the evidence to be exculpatory. Material exculpatory evidence is that.
It doesn't cover the prosecutor's evidence of guilt? That's a new reading of Rule 16.
Rule 16 requires material exculpatory evidence to be revealed by the prosecutor.
But not inculpatory evidence. Is that what you're saying?
It is not under Rule 16, and I agree that it is part of the prosecutional obligation to disclose the information, but it is not a violation of Rule 16 in this particular case because it was not exculpatory. But more importantly, it is the prejudicial aspect of this that is really at issue here. The court granted the request for recess, gave many hours of additional time for the defense to prepare for the following day's cross-examination.
As I read the transcript, this discussion ended at 4:00, so she didn't get many hours. She got from 4 to 5. Is that inaccurate?
Well, the only change, as I suggested, is that further narrowing down among the three options. So the time required to do the investigations had been completed before. The defense was well aware of that. The only thing was to prepare for cross-examination of Mr. Schneeberger, which was done the following day. And there was no complaint that there was not enough time at that point continue the trial for another day. That was not requested. So the additional time that was requested was given based on, defense's understanding that a few hours would be sufficient, and the court granted that.
Mr. Yazdi, would you?
Extensive cross-examination, I'm sorry.
No, finish your sentence, please.
There was extensive cross-examination on this issue the following day. So if there was any question about the misrepresentation by the defense, that was clarified the next day because it was obvious that Mr. Schneeberger had changed his opinion. So the jury was fully, was made fully aware of the situation that he had changed his position and his conclusion. There was no basis for any inference by the jury that for some reason that the opening statement was misrepresented, you know, the intention was to misrepresent. I'm sorry.
You answered one of the questions I was going to ask on that. I was going to ask you to address Mr. Carver's argument about the prosecutor, the defense lawyer looking foolish in front of the jury, which I am concerned about. Would you address his, the other argument that he made, that there's prejudice here because had the defendant gotten any timely notice, the defendant may have chosen to plead guilty or proceeded differently?
Your Honor, there were three fires and three charges related to three incidents. And two of the incidents, there were arson, and there was the positive conclusion that they were arson. If there was any reason to engage in plea negotiations or succeed, they were already known to the defendant that the conclusion is that those two are arsons. And he had, of course, confessed.
But aren't the facts different when you've got three fires and when you're going in, you have evidence that one of them was not arson? And there's a real issue about corpus delicti in this case. So the defendant's thinking, I got a shot at reasonable doubt because I got an investigator who can't figure it out. Now and that changes, well, and he, of course, challenges the confession, but I understand your point. But now you've got a situation where there's evidence of all three. Doesn't that make any difference?
And that was not the argument made below, Your Honor. The argument was never made, the argument that Mr. Carberry made today, that the prejudice is based on lack of information to engage in plea negotiations. I'd like to move on quickly to videotaping issue.
Well, but before you move on, I'd like you to answer this yes or no if you can. Do you agree that defense counsel should have been given notice of Mr. Schneeberger's changed opinion before the prosecutor called him to the stand?
Yes. My only point about the videotaping is that this issue has been raised again only on appeal. So under plain error standard of review, we have to look at what the law was at the time. And the court, of course, would follow the case that Mr. Carberry says it's its old one, Raybon. In 1992, the Court of Appeals specifically decided that videotaping was not required. So this is a very simple issue. The court followed the precedent established already, and there's no reason for this court to find plain error on that basis. And finally, on the question of on the confessions, by the way, Judge Gabriel mentioned the fact that I had discussed Sixth Amendment. This is what Mr. Carberry says about my discussion in reply brief. Quote, the answer brief focuses on the Sixth Amendment, but as trial counsel made clear, she invoked Mr. Rouse's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights to counsel. Even though six reasons that I discussed, three of them have to do with Sixth Amendment, three of them have to do with the Fifth Amendment, so I have addressed both. And even based on that, Mr. Carberry suggests that I didn't address fully. Finally, on the question of fingerprints, the issue is whether the Confrontation Clause rights apply here. And the answer is that it doesn't, because these are not testimonial. So it is irrelevant. Melendez-Diaz is irrelevant to this case because we are not talking about testimonial. There, in that case, there's a question of an affidavit specifically produced for the court. Here we have public records put together, certified, triple certification, for the purpose of habitual criminal sentencing. So there is no basis for a confrontation clause, and there was no violation. Unless the court has any questions, We will ask the court to affirm Mr. Rouse's conviction.
Chassie, I did have one question on a topic you haven't addressed, which is the fourth degree arson convictions. And I'll tell you, I'm a little concerned about that one. And I'd ask you to address, what was the evidence of danger or of death or serious bodily injury? For reasons I don't fully understand, the prosecution went on the personal injury as opposed to property damage. I think the evidence is a little bit thin on that risk, so I'd be interested to hear your response.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that Mr. Carberry seems to agree with me that there was potential danger. But he distinguishes between actual danger and potential danger, and I don't understand what that distinction means, because when we talk about endangerment, we are talking about putting people at risk of being harmed. And when you have we have fires in a neighborhood of townhomes, single-family residences, close to each other, and early in the morning, the kind of situation that we look at, there was seriously chances of fire expanding, and defendant himself even justified this by saying that the reason he got out of his house was that he was afraid that the fire might get into his house before he, of course, confessed to having set up the fires. So it is obvious that the setting itself is sufficient to establish that there was potential harm for serious bodily injury or even death to people who resided in those residences. At that time, they could have been sleeping and without even realizing could have lost their lives. And I also, as I have cited in my brief, Copeland, in that case, the court concluded that even putting the firefighters at risk of losing their lives is sufficient to establish the endangerment element of arson.
Can you give me an example then of a case where that wouldn't apply, where there's a fire at a home? Every fire at a home, I think you have on your theory, will have that risk and a risk to a firefighter.
My time is up.
No, answer the question, please.
One could hypothesize that under certain circumstances where there's no one there, there's a building and firefighters would not immediately be notified, and some other people, would take action, so firefighters would not be immediately responding. So I understand Your Honor's point, but it is hypothetically possible.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd just like to say one thing in my rebuttal argument. Rule 16 codifies Brady against Maryland's constitutional rule that the prosecution must disclose all material evidence. It's not just exculpatory evidence, it's material evidence, and the rule requires that it be disclosed at least 30 days before trial. And for those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse Mr. Rouse's convictions and to remand for a new trial. Thank you.
One question, if I could, please. Was, and I realize you weren't trial counsel, was the videotape issue raised below? Because I think this is one of those unusual cases where plain error may make a huge difference.
I think it was, but I cannot say for a fact, Judge. I'd have to look that up.
That's fair.
I apologize.
You're welcome. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case is submitted. Counsel are excused. We will be issuing a written opinion in due course.